You're listening to a Scottish Poetry Library podcast.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Scottish Poetry Library podcast. I'm Ryan Van Winkle, your host for this episode. And today on the podcast, we've got Sasha Dugdale. You might know her as the editor of Modern Poetry and Translation. It's a fantastic magazine, legendary magazine, in fact. And so just on that level, it was a huge privilege to get a chance to speak to her. But she's also a poet in her own right, and she's got a book out called Red House. It's from Carcanet. It's a really thrilling collection of poetry. It's an exceptional book. And here she is to talk about it. Sasha Dugdale.
I'm Sasha Dugdale, and I'm going to read a poem called Dawn Chorus. And this poem is a sort of failed translation in a sense, because behind it lies another poem, a Russian poem called The Prophet by Pushkin. And many of the words and the images come from that poem, although in fact the poems are completely different and about completely different things, but something of the urgency of Pushkin's poem crept into mine. Dawn Chorus. March the 29th, 2010. Every morning since the time changed, I have woken to the dawn chorus. And even before it sounded, I dreamt of it. Loud, unbelievably loud, shameless, raucous. And once I rose and twitched the curtains apart, expecting the birds to be pressing in fright against the pane like passengers. But the garden was empty and it was night. Not a slither of light at the horizon. Still the birds were bawling through the mists. Terrible, invisible, a million small evangelists. How they sing, as if each had pecked up a smouldering coal, their throats singed and swollen with song, in dissonance as befits the dark world, where only travellers and the sleepless belong.
That's a great last line.
I think, if I remember rightly, that poem was longer and I was trying to say more in it than I could really. And I ended up pulling back and retreating to what I knew best. And that was probably the line where it stopped.
Yeah, just like it was one of the lucky ones where you actually are like, oh, if I just cut it off there, oh, that works.
Pretty much, although it's hard to remember back. It's actually a strange poem because it also hides in it an event. The subtitle of the poem is a date, and that date is a day when a bomb exploded in the Moscow metro, and it exploded at about, rush hour, because of the time difference. That is roughly when the dawn chorus sounds here. And I woke for that dawn chorus because the times had changed. It was in March. I was still waking too early, and I heard the news a little later. So there is that sinister event behind
it. Yeah, you can really feel that. That's so interesting to say that, because especially, again, that really captivating last line grabs that kind of tension and that feeling of sinisterness. How important is it to you that people are aware of that or not aware of that? Or is it okay? Because I was just thinking about this morning. Is it okay that if you're just left with the remnants and the resonance of those feelings and you have the sinisterness built in, and if they don't know that there's a particular event that's on your mind, just is in there, that fear, that mood is in that poem, right?
Yeah, that's a really tricky one. And I don't quite know if I can adequately answer it. I've done it with a couple of poems. There's another poem I wrote called Princes. And that poem has a subtitle, which is a day, and it's a day when somebody I knew died in a bomb attack in a violent way. But the poem was about something entirely different. So I left the date as a kind of epitaph, really, in it. You know, if I read the poem, I might sometimes tell people what the date is there for, and sometimes I don't. And it's an interesting thing whether you reveal everything, because in a way, the poem has its own life and its own wholeness, its own integrity. And sometimes those other events which might have provoked it and might be in it, they don't need to have a life beyond that. The poem takes its own, what it wants.
I'm thinking of there's a Sarah Broom poem. I don't know if you know her work at all. She was with Carcanet, a New Zealand poet. And you know, I think it just started with, it's called Snow, if anybody wants to look it up. And the first couple of lines have when we heard the news, but you never find out what the news was. You just know it's probably not good, right? You know, like that feeling is just there, palpable, and then you don't really get into it. It doesn't really matter what the actual thing is. just the feeling is what makes the difference, or what makes the poem work. And then people can put whatever they want on that mood. Like, I'm thinking about reasons people would be awake at dawn, listening to the dawn chorus with that nervous energy. It could be anything. It could be, you know, a problem in a relationship. It could be a problem with parents, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think that's right. And there's another thing that it's very difficult to write directly about certain things, particularly bad news, particularly, you know, violence or current events, really. It's really hard to write about them. You need an awful lot of filters, obliqueness to write anything, I find, anyway.
Yeah, that's actually really true, because, right, you read an anti-war poem or like a thing, and it just is too close, too newsy, too much trying to tell you what it is that the author thinks, what maybe I should think as a reader, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit like Keats said, we don't like poetry that has a palpable hold on us. Yeah. Poetry that puts its hands in its breeches pocket. And there is something of that. You just turn you off when you know a poem or a poet wants you to think a certain way.
Yeah, so write a poem about bowling, and if you can get an anti-war message in there, that would be pretty good.
That should be one of the challenges for for a writing workshop.
Yeah. Yeah, take my poetry school class. You'll get so you'll get fun. You'll get exercises that I made up. but yeah, it's really fun. And I was just so glad to hear that poem, because the dawn chorus. I was with a sound artist, and we were in Northampton doing a project, and he woke us up at 5 a.m. to go listen to lay in a graveyard and listen to the dawn chorus. It was incredible.
It's a strange thing. And in fact, it is what the poem's about. It's that extraordinary noise that birds make when they're sounding out their voices, I suppose. But it all happens at about 4 o'clock in the morning. And it isn't a nice noise, in fact. I mean, people write dawn chorus poems and they sing dawn chorus songs, but it's not actually a very nice noise. It's slightly chilling. It's quite frightening. It's every bird, all the ones you've seen and all the ones you've never seen, and they're all out there. And there is something vaguely frightening and sort of Hitchcockian about this sound.
And just the time of day, that mood, like even, you know, just before the light comes up, it's just a really weird, nobody's on the streets, the streetlights are still on, you know, that kind of feeling.
Yeah, that's it. It's a dark place. It's not a world of human, it's not a world that's inhabited by human beings.
Do you find yourself going, do you push yourself to go do these things? Like, you know, I think today you said you were in Edinburgh, you climbed up Arthur's Seat. You sound like somebody who like rolls your sleeves up and does things.
I suppose I quite like experiences. So I do go and look for them, mostly in the natural world. I'm a really keen walker. So I do lots and lots of walking whenever I can. And I like walking at night, and I like walking early in the morning. Whenever I can fit that in, I try to do it, because it does always renew something in you. It makes you feel things freshly and differently.
Yeah, they say it's a really, I mean, I never walk. And when I do walk, I like it, but I'm a cyclist and I always cycle. And then you start reading these things and they're like, it's supposed to be good for you. I need to start thinking of walking as work, and then I'd do it.
I don't know if there's any hierarchy of experiences. I think cycling's probably fine.
No, it's not as good. It's too fast. It's too fast and it's too dangerous. Yeah, so you can't get that mental space of like that just nice rhythm where you're walking and you're thinking things. Tell me about why you consider this a... The Dawn Chorus, and there was a few other poems in the new collection that you were saying were kind of translations.
Yeah, well, Russian poetry is really, really hard to translate. It's very particularly of itself. And in order to translate it, you have to find sort of equivalents in English. And I often come across poems that I would love to translate, and I just don't have the resources to translate them. They're always extraordinarily intricate, but at the same time, they're wonderfully lyrical. And you know what it's like translating a poem like that? Needs a degree of sort of, I suppose, inspiration, really. You need to have a moment when you see how it would sound in English, and that doesn't always happen. So there's a poem in Red House, which is called Michael Blann, which is a translation of a Pasternak poem called Hamlet, which I tried to translate and just couldn't do. I just couldn't do it. But what I had there that was successful came into a poem about something completely different. And I didn't do that consciously. It's not that I sat there with notes and thought, right, I can use this for this. It just simply happened. Those lines that I had provoked a different poem in me. So in a way, it isn't so much as a failed translation as a sort of response, really. But it's also the fact that with the Pushkin poems, you know, Pushkin is sometimes called the sun in Russian poetry, and you cannot look at the sun. You have to wear very, very dark sunglasses, or you have to, you know, protect yourself. And sometimes I find that I read Pushkin best when I'm filtering him or looking at him in an oblique way. So that's the case with that poem, The Prophet, which stood behind my poem, Dawn Chorus. The Prophet would be very hard to translate adequately into English. And for that reason, I almost felt as if I couldn't. I had to turn away and do something completely different. But in a way, it is a translation because it's a reading of The Prophet, the poem The Prophet. The Prophet is a poem in which Pushkin describes the poet. He's kind of attacked by a six-winged seraph. The seraph tears out his tongue and replaces it with a burning coals, and I think opens his chest and takes out his heart. I can't quite remember the poem. It's incredibly visceral and violent. But then the poet is sent off to spread the word. And that was, a sort of Pushkinian vision of how the poet might be. And yes.
That's great. But I love this idea of using your own material or using these translations and then kind of the translations fail, but you end up getting spare parts, essentially, right? And you just, that'll work okay over here. And giving yourself the permission to do that, was that hard to be able to say to yourself, actually, this isn't okay to do, to take this piece and use it for this?
It's not so much spare parts, because I'm not sure that would work for me. It's more like a fire that you've lit, and it might not be wholly there, but you can take fire from it and light another fire. It may not be the conflagration you imagined, but you can take a spill from it and light another fire, or you can carry a branch or two.
It's so interesting because you do so much work with translation, and to see that kind of affecting your own work and your own practice, there can't be that many people who are that closely working as poets and as somebody doing kind of concentrating on translations so much.
Translations are quite hard to work into a poetic life because, in fact, you're trying to mimic someone else's voice often, or you're in dialogue with a particular poet when you're translating, and sometimes that wipes out your capacity to write as an individual poet. So although poetry translation has lots of real benefits, so it helps you kind of limber up linguistically, there are also difficult things about translation, things that actually silence you as a poet. So you have to get a sort of balance.
Yeah, and of course you don't have to think, the great thing, you don't have to think of the material. You don't need to think of the moment that you're writing. You just get the fun bit. I always think of when doing a translation, of like shaping the poem and editing it. But you don't actually have to do the like, hey, I'm going to write a poem about, I don't know, my kitchen.
That's a very interesting way of looking at it. And it's sort of slightly different for me. It's not that, because in a sense that the theme of a poem is pretty much immaterial to me. It's more about the sound of a poem and the sort of spark that gives you a line of sound that you want to continue. So in fact, in that sense, translation is like poetry because, for example, I'm translating a Mandelstam poem at the moment, Slyshu, slyshu, ranny lyod, it starts. And how do you translate that into English? I'm just walking around with it in my head. And in a sense, it isn't the actual literal meaning that's troublesome. It's the sound, how to convey that into English. So it has the same magic. Slyshu, slyshu, ranny lyod, shelestyeshi pod mostami.
Can you give me a literal translation?
A literal translation would be, I hear the early ice creaking beneath the bridges. So it's the sound of ice on the river creaking beneath the bridges.
That's very good.
He's the master.
He was all right, wasn't he?
He was about the gold standard.
As you're working with modern poetry and translation, who was it? Ted Hughes who started it?
Yeah, it was Ted Hughes and Danny Weisbord, and they started it 50 years ago. So we're celebrating the 50th anniversary, which actually makes it one of the oldest poetry magazines in the United Kingdom.
That's crazy. I didn't realize it was around for so long.
It's been there forever, really. And it's had very, very sort of venerable editors, Ted Hughes, Danny Weisbord, and then David and Helen Constantine took it on, and they did it for 10 years nearly. And I'm only the third set of editors, really. I'm only the third round.
How's that feel?
Well, it's a very congenial job. It's, it's really brilliant reading translation. So it's wonderful. I can see why people sort of stay in post. And it's a great magazine and a good community as well. It's a real community magazine, a bit like the Scottish Poetry Library, where you seem to have a little community built around the actual establishment, the institution. Modern poetry is much the same. We have a little group of people who are incredibly warm, incredibly talented, and the translations we get are fantastic. So in that sense, it's a wonderful magazine to work with. I don't have enough time to write, and that's a different issue, but I love doing it.
But there's never enough time to write, is there? I always think, like, I should take some time off, but I know I wouldn't do it.
Yeah, you could be right. In a way, you have to snatch at the little, that's what being a poet's about. After all, you're not a novelist sitting there writing 3,000 words a day, but there are points when it gets quite critical and you think, God, if I had a week spare, I've got so much stuff accumulating.
Yeah. That's so nice that you say that about. I was wondering, I mean, is because the translation poetry world, I guess it's a slightly different, slightly to the side of the literary establishment, the poetry establishment, in the sense that there probably isn't as much backbiting and worries about egos and stuff. I mean, maybe I'm projecting, but it does feel that way to me.
Well, it's certainly very generous-spirited, and a lot of the people who are involved with MBTR are also poets, and so that the sort of Venn diagram of the world of poetry and the world of poetry and translation does overlap. And I think of, you know, in this issue, we've got George Sertesh, and we've got, you know, some Stephen Watts as a contributor, a long-term contributor. And in the last issue, we had Hubert Moore, who's a, you know, a really wonderful poet. And so there is a good degree of overlap, but it is a very generous-spirited world.
And I guess that comes from the idea that they're doing something that a lot of poets don't get the opportunity to do. And I've done work in translation, and I've been really lucky to work with Literature Across Frontiers and those guys and Highlight Arts. And it's really important, I think, for poets to try it, because you get a sense of other people's work. You get a chance to talk to them about it. You have this conversation. If they're not even living, you can have that conversation. You could talk, it's not self-centered. The act in itself is not a self-centered act, which I think is really important and really humbling in a way. And it's a big responsibility as well.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's always a dialogue translation. You're always in dialogue with another poet and the poet you're translating. And it's often collaborative as well. So you often have collaboration between writers and literal translators. So there's a lot of, you know, community built into translation, which is really, which is quite utopian in a way. I find it quite a utopian sort of thing to do.
Yeah, that's right. That's absolutely, I totally agree with that. Yeah, it is a utopian experience. Coming out of the like workshops or coming away from it is really like going back to the real world. It's weird. And going back to your own work, it's kind of weird.
Okay, so this poem was written about coming across a house, really, while I was out on a long distance walk. And we'd been walking all day, pretty much. We came across this house, which was derelict. There's no road to it, only the way we'd come by foot. And you always ask yourself when you get to somewhere like that, how did people live there? How did they come in and go out? Or did they just live in the landscape and never move? So that's the sort of kind of locus, I suppose, of the poem. Do you remember how we chanced upon a home, a long way from anywhere, with no way of arriving or departing except by foot, as we had come? We rested in meadow grass that was yellow and thriving, breaking its way through the once level stone, sharing its gains with the ragwort and ivy, the poppies and the briar rose. Memory makes that devastation in our shape, a place of man that man forgoes and leaves for memory to unmake, in wild creation that masks the hollow eye and rotting hay and rusty rake. Nothing will ever die that lives, though all its form be changed. So there we stopped a bit and lay. And now the hours and days are rearranged. The bodies lying there are beyond strange, like angels glaring through one peacock eye.
Tommy, you said something really nice that I want people to hear about getting accepted into the Edinburgh Review.
Yeah, I was really touched because I'd not written a great deal since Red House, and writing has been very slow because of MPT. And I think it's inevitable that you always define yourself by your last poem, and you get to the point where you're actually not writing and you feel quite fraudulent, really. You know, people ask you to talk about poetry and you think, well, I'm not actually somebody who writes it. It's very hard to keep that sense of yourself as somebody who's a writer if you're not doing it. And I think you lose confidence quite quickly. It sort of drains away and you wonder if you're ever going to write again. So I had some poems which Alan asked me if I would send. So I sent them off and I said, I've no idea if they're any good, but if there's anything you want from them, please take it. And he accepted them for Edinburgh Review, and it was extraordinary. I was very, very grateful to him. can't actually, you know, it's difficult to say really how grateful I felt, because it was almost like a confirmation that it was still possible and it was still going to be part of my life.
I'm in the same issue, and yeah, I felt the exact same way, in the sense that I was in the same point. I had finished a collection and sort of like, I have some new things that maybe aren't very good, and then that stamp of validation, that little moment of like, somebody likes me, is so important. And I can't stress enough, like, and especially as you're an editor, I just wanted to get on the podcast that like, people need to support these magazines, man.
Yeah, I've realized that more. And I mean, I realized that more and more too. And I sort of really chide myself for, you know, in the past when I didn't necessarily support a lot of magazines, and I see actually how important it is. So, you know, I've been lucky enough to realize that through working with MPT. But yeah, I think it's a small community, and we need to look out for each other. And it's been a great lesson to me, MPT, in that.
Yeah, it's so important just to have people who are just reading each other's work and talking about it, and just, you know, saying, yeah, that's good. That's good enough, or good enough even. I'd be happy with a good enough. You know, if Alan had written back and said, these are good enough, I'd be like, oh, all right, I'm onto something.
Yeah, good enough is kind of a great way of summing it up, actually, because, you know, that's all we can hope for.
Yeah, my old professor used to say, oh, these are publishable. I wasn't sure it wasn't exactly a compliment.
Yeah, I'm not so sure about publishable.
What are you working on now that what point are you between collections? Are you looking towards something else, or just gathering material? How do you write in that sense? Are you somebody who kind of sits down and thinks, I need to get a theme together and start working on my poems about dogs, or...
No, not at all. I'm not a theme poet. I mean, I'm pretty much a sort of lyric poet in a way. I suppose I write when I need to write, and I don't write when I don't need to write. So the idea of a theme collection would be quite hard for me, although I can see that collections naturally theme themselves, because you know, they're chronological often, and you're in a way just recounting the particular preoccupations, the time when you wrote those poems. But beyond that, no.
Do you have you sensed a particular preoccupation of the moment?
I'm very preoccupied by history, because I'm witnessing what's happening in Russia, because I'm a Russian translator and I work a lot with Russia. So I'm quite preoccupied with the political situation in Europe, and watching how it unfolds, and also thinking back and knowing what I know now, reassessing how I felt about various points in European history. So, you know, the Cold War or the First World War even. So I think that's a very conscious preoccupation. Whether that's crept into my poetry or not, I don't know.
Yeah, I was going to say, you can't even see it yet. You can kind of feel it around the edges, but you can't see it entering in just yet.
No, sometimes you look back and see it rather than knowing it at the time.
Yeah. Go, oh, that was what that was about. I had no idea. Yeah, I love those moments when the penny drops on your own poem. God knows how hard it is for other people to read and figure out what's going on. And then you can fix it, right? And then you can shape it a little bit more and go, okay, if this is going to be something about World War One, then we're going to shape it a little bit. If this is going to be about the Cold War, we can shape it. We could add a word or two in just to push it a little bit over the line. Is that something that you might...
That would be something I really never do, actually. I'm quite different in that respect, because I'm not really... If a conscious preoccupation isn't making itself felt in a poem, then that poem won't hold that preoccupation, and I have to just live with that and find a poem that will hold it. I can't shape poems to fit what I consciously want from them. That doesn't work for me at all, although I know it works for others.
What about shaping the poem created by your subconscious, consciously shaping it?
I do shape poems, and I work quite hard on them, and sometimes I'm quite surprised when I look back at the draftings and I think, gosh, I've put more work into this than I realize, because partly because it's quite effortless work. You're doing it, you're absolutely occupied by it, you're totally kind of transfixed by the activity, so you don't necessarily notice how much you're doing and how long has passed. I tend to work on it really more for sound or shape than preoccupation. I suppose I'm quite interested in sound, so I speak aloud when I'm writing and I speak aloud when I'm revising. So that has to be the sort of primary focus of the reversion, you know, redrafting.
You can't do that in an open office.
No, it's really terrible. It's just terrible. Can't do it in a library either.
You can't go to a cafe and work on your manuscript. Yeah, you have to sit solitarily. Let's hear this new poem, please.
This morning I sat and cut apples. I cut them into four, and then I nicked each part, and brought my knife around the curve. And through long practice, I kept my thumb up tight against the blade, and when I twisted the blade inside each quarter, it returned to my thumb. And the quarters I put into the pan with lemon, and the peel and corners of apples I heaped onto the board. There was a silence. My thoughts wandered. I thought about absence, which so hates to be considered. It throws the thoughts back out like thieves and bolts the door behind them. More and more my thoughts besieged his hovel, tarred wooden shelter on the beach. Again and again the thoughts came limping, black-eyed, dented, tossed by the inhospitable absence, back to me at my cutting board, to be dispatched again with an oath. I want to know, says the despot mind, what this place is, what is inside the home of absence. Where are my best men? I sent my best thoughts, the ones I keep to guard me through the dark hours. They too came reeling and bloodied back. At last, my youngest thought came to me. Father, says he, let me try where others failed. Let me enter the house of absence. Whatever knowledge it might contain, I will fight for it and bring it home. And off he flew, my most recent thought, who came to the home of absence and found the door wide open, swinging like a thumb on a knife blade. He fell in love with absence and threatens now to return forever. He is betrothed and thinks of nothing else.
Sasha Dugdale, everybody. Her book is Red House. You can get it from Carcanet Press. Thank you so much to her for sitting down, taking the time to talk to us while she was up in Edinburgh. Also, if you get a chance, pop into the Scottish Poetry Library and check out Modern Poetry in Translation. One of the great things the SPL does is it houses a fantastic repository of literary magazines from around the world. Modern Poetry in Translation is one of those, and it's very, very much worth checking out. It's got great new work from all over the place in it. Go and flip through it when you get a chance. And of course, if you can't get to the Scottish Poetry Library, make sure to subscribe. I'm sure Sasha would very much appreciate it. That's all for today's episode. We'll be back in your ears very, very soon with more fantastic poetry action. But until then, goodbye for now. This episode was produced by Colin Fraser of Culture Laser Productions for the Scottish Poetry Library.
Thank you for downloading this Scottish Poetry Library podcast. For further information about the Scottish Poetry Library, visit our website at www.scottishpoetrylibrary.org.uk, follow us on Twitter at By Leaves We Live, and find us on Facebook.